So welcome, guys. Hank has joined us today to answer a question I've heard come up in the group a few times. Members have asked about hiring a CFO, about outsourcing their CFO duties, about having their bookkeeper be an accountant and a CFO, about having a CFO full-time, part-time, so all these questions in that space. Hank is somebody I've known for many years. We actually met on the East Coast and then found out that we were pretty much neighbors. I could throw a baseball in probably his house. We walked past his house all the time. And in fact, we both got home from our trip, and that day Hank happened to walk past our front door. So strangers who were neighbors meeting all the way across the world. And so Hank's been a great resource and a good friend and an expert in this space, and so I thought, who better to come share with our group about hiring your first CFO, when to do it, when not to, and how that all looks. So with Hank, I'll hand it over to you, and let's take it from there. So thanks for joining us.
Good. Thanks so much for having me. I'll probably go back and forth between sitting down and standing up. I just want to say at the beginning, it's hard for me to know how much people in the room know already about this subject. So if it turns out that we go a little faster and get some more Q&A, there's some things that I didn't include in the presentation, such as when to do planning bottoms-up or tops-down, a variety of different things to sort of look at. But I wanted to give you an introduction of hiring your first CFO. So my agenda is to talk, in a minute I'll tell you a little bit about my background and why I do what I do. We'll talk about what's a CFO and why might you need one. You already have an accountant and bookkeeper, so how would a CFO add value to your business? When's the right time and what should I look for in a CFO? I mentioned that I did a case study with Logan. And again, this was just an initial meeting and a looking at his things. You know, once a CFO gets to know you better, there's a lot more, but I thought we came up with... I'll actually invite Logan, and please be direct. You can share how the experience was after our short thing. And then the Q&A, hopefully we have fun. So who am I? What I'd really like to share is that when I was between 5 and 6 years old, my dad lost a business he inherited. His dad had passed just before I was born, and it was women's clothing and then separate children's clothing shops all through South Florida. So you mentioned Miami-Dade, that's where I grew up. It had an incredible impact on him and our entire family. And it took me a long time to figure out how much impact this had, but I have studied business basically since that time because it had been my goal that we should never have to go through such a tremendous, difficult period. I ended up going to some great schools. I started at Duke, thinking Lara Business School. I got in econ and poli-sci and actually worked with a professor who'd been a peer of Milton Friedman. And so got turned on to the Chicago philosophy, and that's where I did my MBA. So I actually worked in between that period of time with the Mellon Bank in Pittsburgh and then got my MBA in Chicago and came out where else? Silicon Valley. Because at that time, everything was happening. That's where I wanted to be. And again, I was more focused on small, fast-growing entities, but wanted to work with some large, well-managed companies to see how things should be done. So the first company I came out with was owned by Xerox. Xerox had bought everything out here that could have been the Apple Macintosh. I was working for the Shugart company, which was the old disk drive company. They had successful 8-inch disk drives. They were making the 5 1/4s and getting into the 3.5 at that time, and they were also exploring the optical drives. They went from about $200 to $250 million down to zero in 18 months. I watched that, and I was actually part of the team trying to save the company and work with Xerox from the inside. So we could put that off, but it's a great story. I moved to Intel at that time, and Intel then was going through a similar experience. They had just lost the DRAM business to the Japanese. This was around the 286, 386 time, if you can remember back that far. And they didn't know how to do, we'll get into this, they didn't know how to do cost accounting in their factories. And I was helping to run one of the factories. And I was one of the few people who said, hey, we really need to figure this out to become successful. And at that time, it felt like every quarter Intel was about to go out of business. AMD was a big competitor. There were a lot of different things happening. It was an exciting time to be a part of it. Not long after that, I got into working with small private companies, both venture-backed and non, and had a number of successful acquisitions. I've had every company that I've worked with was prepared to go IPO, but that market has changed a lot for going public. And I wouldn't advise it for too many companies, but I know everything you need to know to get a company ready. I know about Big Four audits and all the rest of those things. So I've had several successful acquisitions. And you mentioned MedDevice. I worked with a gentleman named Gary Stroy, who's recently reached out. Do you know Gary?
I think I know. I don't remember the last name, but that's...
Okay, so he was the founder of a variety of companies, but LifeScan with the fingerprint for the... And he's known as the godfather of...
Yeah, he's sort of the cross-advisor from the company that I work
with. Is that right? So he's reached out. He wants me to help him with a company up in the East Bay right now. But one of the exciting opportunities I had was working with Gary.
And Manish is his president, right? Manish is working
at the company. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So I also pitched to VCs worldwide. With the company I was with Gary, we went to Taiwan, we went to Norway and the EU, and of course we pitched all through the U.S. So. That's a bit about me. So what the first thing I'd like you to do is to take out a piece of paper. You can write it on your computer, but I'd like it in front of you. What is the main purpose of your business? And I'd like you to include in that purpose, you know, is this to provide ongoing income? Are you trying to grow it big? Or are you looking to build it and then sell it? What is your financial objective along with your purpose? So just take a minute to write that down.
What is the financial objective of the business? Sorry, is that your question?
Well, I want you to kind of write your purpose for your business and include the financial objective. Are you just trying to make income? You want to build it big and sell it? You want to build it big and take it public? You want to build it big and run it? You want it to just grow gradually? What are you trying to do with this business?
Sell it and still have a shirt on my back?
I wrote down every purpose is valid. The one thing I wanted... As you're writing, the one thing I wanted to say is that if you want to be bigger than Amazon and Google combined, just make sure you're in integrity with that purpose, that this is a business that can really outgrow those businesses. But otherwise, just make sure every purpose is valid. So I just want you to write that down. Okay? We'll come back to it. So now the opportunity. What if you could achieve your goal faster, more cost-effectively, with milestones and measurements backed with feedback and guidance?
Not as easy.
What if you could engage a Sherpa who will examine the business foundation you've built, listen to and help refine your goal, and we'll begin with the end in mind. That's why I wanted you to write that down. And then assist you in defining areas to invest, the order in which to proceed, and provide the steps to take to improve your odds of success. So really, this is the goal of the CFO, in my opinion, to really help you grow that business based on what you just decided you want to do. Now, the questions that we'd ask together, you know, is it better for you to invest in, you know, a new or enhanced product line, or are you going to go for more R&D? Or is there more leverage in hiring employees or engaging with contractors or neither? What about a PEO and what should I look for? How about capital equipment? How about insurance? Are you looking to push some risk to somebody else? And if so, how much? And how much should you have as deductible premiums? How much should you take on as self-insurance? And what about debt versus equity? Should I be borrowing money? Should it be short-term in a line of credit, long-term? How do I work with my banker? And if I want equity, how do I speak with investors and what do they need to see? And what's the right way to position this? So here's a bunch of things that a CFO can help you with through that thing. Now, a lot of people that I work with in this space feel that they understand they have to keep books and they understand the accounting, and many of them feel that that's what finance is. And so I don't think so. But a good CFO needs to understand the accounting to take you in the direction of the things that we just talked about. And I thought we should just understand what the difference is between accounting and a CFO. So accounting is known as language of business. It's incredibly important because it's how you keep track of things. But what's the distinction with finance? So first of all, what are the basics of financial accounting? Most of you know it's dual entry, right? We work with debits and credits. There are three types of statements. You've got an income statement, a balance sheet, and a cash flow. They all have to work together. And, you know, for every debit, there's a credit, et cetera. So it all comes together. And you may or may not know that when you use your debit card at the ATM, your accountant or bookkeeper is probably going to list that taking of money out as a credit. And when you borrow money as a liability, that's probably a debit to you. When a bank says, I'm going to put a credit on your statement, that often comes out as a debit. So these things can be confusing. They're really, the way I was taught, is debits are on the left, credits are on the right. That's it. You need to understand where the T account is and where they are, where they sit in the account. There's a bunch of types of accounting, and really it depends on who is the audience. So we just went through financial accounting, and we talked earlier about GAAP. You may also know the European system of IFRS, and there's an attempt to get the U.S. on that, but we pushed back, and so I don't know if that will happen. You may know the difference between cash and accrual accounting, but financial accounting is really a base of rules. You probably have heard about depreciation, double declining balance, you know, straight line. You talked about revenue recognition earlier. I'm seeing a lot of heads who know most of the things I'm talking about in here.
I've heard the term. Yes.
But there's also managerial accounting. So how, you know, financial accounting doesn't necessarily help you run your business. You need to turn that set of numbers into something you can manage. So just for an example, let's say you're looking at a department. You got five engineers in this department. They're producing X, you know, output. You want to think about hiring another engineer. You want to know, is that going to return on investment? But those are the kinds of managerial things you need to know. So there's department accounting. There's a variety of different things that we do to manage a business. The cost accounting, the interesting story I tell about cost accounting, and you may know there's either product or process. So in semiconductors, it's like baking cookies. So it's a process. When assembling widgets, that's product. And you can get into standard versus actual. The fascinating thing is that when I was at Intel, they didn't do cost accounting in the factories. And it was really, the reason they awarded us the Intel Achievement Award, it made a huge difference, and it probably saved the company. Because there was no way when a division went out to its customers and tried to sell a logic semiconductor and needed a better price, they couldn't go back to the factory and say, how do I get a better price? And we changed that. So all that communication could happen. But that whole thing in cost accounting, although it will roll up into the financial accounting, it's a totally different way to look at your business, and depending on what kind of business you have, can be very important.
Can I ask you a question about that?
Sure.
So there's a lot of decision points you're going over here,
mm-hmm.
right, that are covered. You know, cash versus accrual, what depreciation model, product versus process, all these.
Mm-hmm.
I know for a lot of startups, it's usually, here's an idea, let's get working on it, let's start selling things, and at some point later, this gets kind of backfilled in. How important is it to have these conversations before dollar one comes in the door versus what's the cost of change to down the road change over your tax filings or books from cash to accrual or, you know, accounting for product first process? Like, is it common that this stuff gets changed to the better later on?
Yeah, so I can tell you, so I mentioned, some of you came in later, but I mentioned that I'm working on my own business of selling products on Amazon and selling later. So I made the decision to start as a sole prop and not to invest in incorporating and figuring all that out,
yeah.
because there's certain ways once I can handle that from a loss perspective until I start making money. And then the question is, okay, what kind of entity do I want and what kind of accounting do I want that to have? But I also have the background and experience to understand that.
Right.
If somebody who's starting out, I mean, if you're looking to have, say, before Series A investment, you need to be able to present to a VC or an investor group what they're going to get for their money. So what is it that you're trying to do, and how do they know? So you'll have to give them an accounting at least of, say they give you $250,000 to start. What am I going to do with that money? And you need to show them, okay, here's my idea. Here's how I'm going to spend your $250,000. And in 6 to 12 months, I expect to have X result with that money and give them milestones. I don't think you have to have it all figured out at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And as you go along, you can get better at it.
Mm-hmm.
But there is the benefit of having certain things in place when you start.
Right. Okay. Cool. Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome.
I can't help but ask, between cash and accrual,
yeah.
What's the main driving factors?
So the purpose of accrual accounting, again, it's all those rules,
right?
So the main thing they're trying to do with accrual accounting is to say, okay, I got a sale today. What's totally associated with that sale?
It's a forward view.
It's trying to match everything that goes in a period.
Right.
So we talked about revenue recognition earlier. So sometimes you can actually get all the revenue in at the beginning, but you have a 3-year contract.
Deferred revenue.
Right? So you have to put in deferred revenue and recognize so much per month over 36 months, right? And then you would also say, okay, what are the expenses related to that?
So then you accrue them over the period of time. And when you're starting out, cash being so much easier, right, rather than trying to scratch your head and accrue accounting, especially when you're two team members are doing everything.
Well, that's another reason. So I'm sole prop right now, and it's easy to be cash.
Right.
And I don't have to worry about all those things. And then depreciation or the inventory that I have,
right.
I can just know, okay, how much inventory do I have at the end, and everything else gets expensed, right? But once I incorporate, I have to do it differently.
Right. If you incorporate, you have to follow GAAP, right? You have to do accrual.
If you're private, you can get away with staying cash, but it's really technically, in terms of the IRS and other things, they're expecting accrual when you incorporate. And most companies do accrual when you incorporate. Then I also talk about the tax accounting, and you know this is in the news, so they're talking about favoring pass-throughs or C-corps or other kinds of things, and you understand that in a C corp, you get paid either through payroll or dividends, whereas in an S you can pass through and that goes on your 1040.
So what's the talk about changing?
They're trying to take the tax system,
mm-hmm.
and make benefits to corporations, both C corps and pass throughs. They're trying to get the pass throughs to benefit from to be as competitive as the C-Corp, and they're focused on making company entities more competitive in the world market, the world environment.
So if you have a pass-through business, I thought that if it made $1 million, then that passed through to the other entity. Why would they?
It passes through to your personal.
Okay.
Okay.
And what they're trying to do is put special rules on, say, an S or an LLC, where you'll get to mimic more of what a C corp would have done rather than being subject to the personal income tax.
How does that make it more globally relevant?
So the issue is, for example, a lot of corporations are doing what's called inversion, and they're moving their headquarters to other places in the world, because the way the U.S. tax system works right now is you get taxed on every dollar worldwide, whereas many other countries are saying, we're just going to tax you on what's in our country and not elsewhere. And places like Ireland and other places around the world have lowered their tax structure such that it's hard to be located and headquartered in the U.S., and that's why there's $2 to $3 trillion outside of the U.S. that major U.S. corporations don't bring home, because they would have to pay so much on those dollars that once they bring this tax down to 20% plus or minus, that those companies will bring that home, invest more in the U.S. and be more competitive. That the U.S. will be more competitive.
That's the best explanation I've heard. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
They're also doing something for real estate. This is supposed to be real.
Okay, so good. So this is interesting to you all?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
great.
Very good.
If I should go faster, you let me know and we can pass on. So I want you to know there's so much to accounting and all these rules that some people, and you talked about Deloitte, make a very small piece their entire career. Some people can just focus on revenue recognition, and that's their whole life. Okay? Doesn't sound very exciting to me, but some people are excited about that, and they like that, and it's good that there's people in the world like that. But I have to tell you that the thing that I find in running private companies, whether VC-backed or not, I've had to do big four audits for VC-backed companies, and the principal reason is they want to prevent fraud. They want to make sure we're not running away with their money, but they don't do a lot with those numbers. We have to give them managerial numbers and give them a plan and have them understand what the focus is of what we're really doing with the business. So they have the accountants come in, and we have to meet those things because someday we may go public or get sold to a public company, and you need that, but it doesn't really help you run the business. So I'd asked you earlier to write down what the purpose of your business is. Now I'd like you to write down what's the biggest and most important accomplishment you intend to focus on this coming year, 2018. Okay, we good? Okay, now what I'd like you to do is turn 180 degrees and look at the wall behind you. Okay, now you're doing accounting. That's what accounting does. It looks behind you where you've been. And all that accounting will do is tell you what's happened by a certain set of rules, right? It's not looking at what you just wrote on the paper. It's not looking at what your goals are. It's not looking on taking you to the next step. In fact, you have your back to that information. If you turn back, this is really much more important to your business, looking at where you want to go, right? And so a lot of people think accounting and finance is exactly the same thing, and I say they're 180 degrees different. Counting, you were just looking behind you. That's it. That's all it does. Okay? And finance looks in front, takes that information, and it says, okay, how should we make your future accounting look right? But really what a CFO does, or what I feel is the most important piece, is really finding out who you are, what it is you're trying to do with your business, where is it that you're trying to go, and what are the things that we should do to get you there. Okay? And so that's what I really think the difference is in accounting and finance. And that's where, you know, you talked earlier, Vern, about you hired a new gal and you said finance and accounting. I listened very carefully. And then you said she really knows her revenue recognition. I was like, okay, that's accounting. Okay, and you need that. I know your business needs that. But the question I would have is she really finance this? Does she really help you do budgets? Does she help you really look at this business and where you're going to go? Does she really help you understand where to invest in the business, those kinds of things? If not, she's more accounting. That doesn't mean she's not a good resource for you. And your business depends on revenue recognition. And you know what? That resource is hard to find.
When you go through a couple of years of having books that are barely adequate or almost unfunctional, and to have all the stuff up to date and have somebody coming and saying, you know, do you need to track this type of expense versus, you know, marketing versus paid ads, you know, and
right.
then it's like, now we can have an account and I can see in the balance sheet or in the profit and loss how much I spend.
And you have to have that.
Right.
And in no way am I trying to put down accounts. And, you know, it could come across that way because, yes, I do giggle and laugh about it. In fact, this lady I was telling Logan about earlier, who the climate change gal who used to be my right hand, best hire I ever had. Uh-oh, are we okay?
Of course.
When I first hired her, she really didn't understand accounting. She was basically going to be an executive admin, but I knew she was much more, so she started helping me. And one day I said to her, she came to me and she had some question about the accounting because she was learning how to do the book. And I said, I just giggled and laughed and I said, that's something we're going to have to ask the Deloitte folks or the accountant. She went away and said, okay. And about 20 or 30 minutes later, an hour, she comes back and she says, I thought that's what you do. You know, and I just, and so I've just explained to you where I think the difference is, and there's people over at Deloitte or PwC or whatever who just specialize in knowing all the rev rec rules or all the depreciation rules or all the other stuff. I don't need to know those rules to help you with your business. I need to know those rules to present, you know, accounting information for a Big Four audit, and so I know how to ask that question and get it done right, but I don't need to know how they're changing every single rule or what they're doing. Right. So the whole point of finance in terms of business planning and analysis, so we take where you've been, and that's described by the accounting, and I'm glad you have good accounting because somebody like me would need to see that. Your experience, your results, I want to hear about your vision, and then I'm going to help you develop long-term and short-term goals. We're going to define and help drive the future with a focus on return on investment, and we'll project those future financial statements. Now, there's a lot of things. So, for example, you went first this morning. There's a lot of things we don't know that's going to happen in your business, but we're going to take a shot at projecting. And should you be spending more time? My thought is let's spend some time on sales, and we'll talk about, you know, how much should we invest in that area of your business. And then you have two pieces to your business, right? And, you know, what's the investment and what's the return and where do you think things are going to go? And we sit down and talk about, okay, what's the relative return? Where should the next dollar go? And what, you know, should we be hiring or should we be investing? Or, you know, should you find somebody outside who can do those kinds of things? Those are all the questions. So when do you need this? So my belief is that when your vision and your motivation requires that you grow more quickly than you can possibly accomplish on your own. Okay? That's when it's needed. Now, is it smart to get it first thing? Of course. Can you always afford it? Not always, right? So you're making normal business decisions. What's the risk I'm going to take and how much am I willing to do? Okay, I feel that the best definition I ever heard of a great CFO is that he's a frustrated general manager. Okay? He's a guy who really thinks like a business owner. And to some extent, you want somebody who almost thinks that they can come in and run the business better than you. Now, I'm humble enough to know that's not possible. Okay? You know way more about your business than I do. But there's things that I'm going to see and talk about that you don't see. And that's where he can provide guidance and enjoy seeing you succeed. And that's his purpose. So So what type of experience should that person have? What I need you to understand is that CFO is not one type of person. My brother-in-law, so my wife, one of my wife's two brothers, has served, he's currently CFO of State Street Bank in Boston. Huge company, right? His job and his understanding, although we can talk finance and different things, his job is totally different. A public company CFO needs to talk to Wall Street and the investment community, needs to understand Big Four audits and all those kinds of things. That person's life is not nearly what I would describe as a CFO for small business and small, fast-growing or VC-backed businesses who understand how to talk to VCs, what it means to start a business, what kinds of issues you're going through when you're going through a business. My brother-in-law can't relate, you know, to most of the businesses in this room. So there's different kinds of CFOs, and my belief is that it depends on the size of company and essentially whether it's public or private, because a public CFO has to do many different things. You can go to jail today because of Sarbanes-Oxley, if you know about this. This was back when Arthur Andersen got in trouble for the big company that was selling the electrical stuff.
Enron.
There were some
Tyco
other
Electric was the one. Okay.
But Enron is the one I was thinking of. I mean, it actually caused Arthur Andersen to go out of business.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yes.
And you know what, the Big Four, they used to be the Big Eight, but they can't necessarily catch every type of fraud. They should have seen that one, I think. But in any case, a CFO of a public company could potentially go to jail if, you know, over Enron kind of stuff. And that they changed the rules. So there's many different things that one has to know. But for a company that's on a fast growth path from beginning to, you know, 50 or 100 million, you need someone who's seen how to do that. They, in my opinion, they don't necessarily need to understand everything about your industry. They need to have a breadth of experience so that they can ask you the right kinds of questions and understand where the leverage points are and can help you decide those other kinds of issues. Where should you be investing? Where's the return? What are the kinds of things you need to do? And have seen those kinds of things. You need someone who's not just analytical, but is very good at analytical and stuff, but understands the practical aspects of your business. So there's some people who are great at the analytical theory stuff, but aren't going to be helpful. You know, and you're fighting the daily things that are coming up. You need somebody who can really get practical. And they're also good at people skills and negotiating acumen. So that's my feeling about us. We're doing all right, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Metrics and key performance indicators, KPI. So I really think that every business, and we got into this with Logan. I compliment Logan, because, and he says he wasn't always this way. So he's grown his business, and I can talk out loud about your business, right? So what I saw from his results is that back in 2014, he had a $500,000 business. And in 2016, he's grown that to a $2 million revenue business. And this year, he's probably going to exceed that by...
2.5 or so?
Yeah. I mean, I only saw the numbers through October, which are $2 million, so it depends on... And he expects a big December, so we're going to talk about that in a minute. But the real thing you want for yourself is to really define what are the gauges, what are the kinds of things you need to be watching. You know, it's not just it's great that you're now getting good financials. Okay, within those good financials, what are the metrics and key performance indicators? So we talked earlier about understanding which ads are getting you the leads. So that's very important for you. And there are other things in terms of managing the salesperson. Those would be very good things to understand. And for each of your businesses, there's going to be certain metrics that will really help us define down into what needs to happen. Now, you can be looking at what the industry standards are. And always keep your eye on the other guys as well. What are the competitive benchmarks? So some of the things that just are generic are things to look at for an AR metric is day sales outstanding. So you want to be collecting your AR, and the faster you are, the less cash, you know, you're going to need to find. I'm going to talk about Logan again, but we talked about inventory turns, so leave that for a few minutes. But you also need to understand, okay, the net income percentage, the gross profit percentage, the overhead percentages, the marketing and advertising percentages. So what's going on in your industry, and what are the competitors doing? What are the kinds of things that you could be, you know, are you spending more or less than other businesses your size? And businesses, and then if we also target, okay, you're going to be growing by leaps and bounds, how do we want to invest based on what the industry targets are? And if we want to do something different, what kind of return are we expecting from that investment in that particular area of the business? And I put pricing metrics, so in terms of how you price your product, you know, what kind of testing have we done? How do we know that we... You know, is it price sensitive or is it price insensitive? And we could do a lot of things. And are certain pieces of the market price insensitive and other things? So how could we extract more for what we're doing? And where do we need, you know, where do we need to price certain things? So first of all, I wanted to get you the theory. So that's what we've talked about. We've talked a little bit about why the difference between accounting and finance. We've talked a little bit about what I think a good CFO could do. And I took a little bit of my own time and gave value, I hope, to Logan, so that I could share that with you. And I'd like to just take a moment, and I can take it, whatever you want to say. How was the initial experience of what we did?
Yeah, it was good. It was, as you said, I was doing a lot of things right, so that felt good, because, as I said, wasn't always that way, so that I'm on the right track and moving in the right way, and you were going to mention, like, a CEO, and that happened to be something that we were looking at right at that moment, so it was a lot of good confirmation, but also pointing out, like, the inventory turns, you know, some numbers that I wasn't tracking, actually didn't even know what they meant, that now I can add on and start looking at those, so those metrics should be a lot of help.
Great. Okay, and the next several pages I put down some of the things that we've talked about so that you could get an idea, but he sent me a bunch of financials. 2014 I saw, 2016, and later he sent me 2017 to date. But I used the accounting statements as a beginning point, but then really got into, okay, what, you know, where is he going with this business? What's going on? I learned about, he has his two businesses, right? He has his own business about strength, mm-hmm. and the second business is you're partnering with two brothers,
yep.
and this one's growing better than that one,
mm-hmm.
and how you've gotten yourself to a point where you are able to work on the business and not just in the business.
Mm-hmm.
And the kinds of things that he's done. So in a short period of time, we were able to get to some high-level things that Logan's done, and then some specifics. But I need to tell you, it's a bit of a risk, because we only spend an hour together on the phone. I spent some time doing some research when he sent me the thing. But when you're working with a CFO, this is someone you don't necessarily need to have them full-time, depending on the size of your company. But making significant evaluations of a company in an hour is a pretty short period of time. So please understand that I wanted to give value, but there's probably a lot of other things that we could, this was just a start,
yeah.
and there's probably a lot of other things that we could get into, but I'd like to share with you some of the things I learned about his business so you could, we're not just talking theory. Is that fair?
Yeah.
Okay. So thanks again for volunteering. I really appreciate that. So metrics. That was what I ended with a minute ago. And one of the things that I saw, he has a number of metrics, and he's got, it's a Google sheet, right?
Yeah.
With charts and things that's keeping track of a variety of different metrics that he's watching. But one of the things that I noticed is that in his business, he's got negative cash. So he's going into his line of credit. And one of the things that he's not watching is what his inventory turns are. And by watching inventory turns, he should be able to optimize, hopefully reduce certain areas within his inventory so that he's squeezing cash out of that and putting it back into his bank account and taking less from the letter of credit, or the line of credit.
Can I ask a question, I think?
Yeah.
So having a purely finance view of the business, and just look at the numbers is great, how do you account for the softer things? For example, you know, if Logan says, look, when we order, it's not just about getting bulk, but there's a risk of things being held up in customs or whatever else, so there's this fuzzier date range, so we're almost incentivized to order more so that we have more inventory. But from a financial standpoint, it looks like, oh no, you're buying way too much, you should buy less or sell more, et cetera. How do you account for that with the left column and right column?
Yes, and that's...
that kind of stuff.
Well, I think you just pointed out a huge difference between an accountant and a finance person.
Yeah.
You need a finance person who can understand the gray.
Right.
Okay? The accountant doesn't look at gray.
Right.
The accountant follows the rules.
For example, like...
where it goes.
For example, employee turnover. We were talking earlier example this morning of, you know, hey, what if we change our compensation structure? We might lose a sales rep, right? We might. There's a risk of that. That's a softer number. Purely financial, it's easy to say, oh, change the thresholds, hire more, et cetera. But the finance view, or the business-specific view, has those softer components.
So I think it was like 3 slides ago where I said analytical yet practical.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I meant by
okay.
that bullet.
Cool.
Is that you need somebody who's been in the trenches and understands that you can't just, it's not just right or left.
Right.
And it's not just black or white.
Right.
It's, okay, we're making business risk decisions every time.
Yeah, with unknowns.
With unknowns.
Yeah.
And where do we think the right thing is going? So just to go back to, I'm not picking on you, but
okay.
you shared this morning. So that's where I listen. And again, it's probably unfair for me to make certain determinations on so little data. But that's where I said I think the biggest thing in your business is sales. We need to, and there's still a lot of the pieces of that we don't have figured out, and I would have to spend a lot more time to understand the metrics and the different things to even come up with a plan on how to do it, right? But I can immediately say, here's really the leverage point in his business, and we need to spend a lot more time, and I would ask him a lot more questions about what does it take to manage this. We found out, you know, we could get a new college grad, a variety of other things, and come up with some creative ideas, out-of-the-box thinking, hopefully. So yes, you need a CFO who can think out of the box. And you know what? Just because somebody says they're a CFO, one of the things you need, there's a lot of people who've been controllers of companies
mm-hmm.
who then want to inherit the CFO title. And one of the things I've had to advise, so there's a company in the space that I'm working, and I got to know the president, the guy who they brought in as president, and he grabbed me, and he said, look, I have this gal, and she's great, but she basically knows the accounting. I want her to do more of the CFO work. I want her to be a planner. I said, this is really, really hard to do. To get somebody to change their stripes and to think differently and to be a different person. He's working with her. She has successfully, she's going to MBA style, it's not a full MBA, but into MBA training because she does want to become more and he's trying to work with her. But that it's a very difficult transition to make from understanding where all the things are, where the buckets are, how it all works, and how the accountants need to see things and all those rules, to then turn over and become this practical person who can think about, oh yeah, we might lose a salesperson, or we might, you know, who can think that on their own. It doesn't have to be told that.
Right.
And so you really, when you're interviewing a CFO or someone like that, you really, that's what you need. That's a key thing you need to look for in that person.
So what would you say is the difference between an accountant versus a controller versus a CFO?
I would start at bookkeeper.
Mm.
Okay? the bookkeeper knows how to do the checkbook and put the numbers in. Mm-hmm. Hopefully they know debits and credits. They may not even know that. They may know something like Quicken, and they can put, you know, Quicken in the background, if you know dual entry, it's doing it, but but it all also fake it and make a lot of mistakes. An accountant understands the debits and credits, and you guide that person on what you want them to do and where you want them to focus. Mm-hmm. There can be people who just specialize in revenue recognition, and that's all they know because it's so big and so huge. In some companies, it can be their full-time job. And there are other accountants who can do all the books and all the kind of stuff, but that isn't somebody who understands the vagaries of the business, right? Mm-hmm. Where you and I said we're going to get to this, but where you and I started talking about possible different sale times during the year versus the end, that's not something an accountant can really do. The controller, again, sometimes people inherit this title, but a real controller is someone who understands the rules of accounting and can guide an accounting department to where the books are correct every month by a certain period of time, and they're producing correct financials and those kinds of things. And they're able to go in and negotiate in departments and other things, whether somebody's exceeding a PO or doing some other things that they can crack down and say, okay, that's outside the rules of our organization, you can't do that. And when you get onto the finance side, then you start with analysts, right? And you work up to FP&A or managers of FP&A, then you work up, and people come from different directions. So there are CFOs who've come from the Big Four, and their comfort level is more accounting. And I happen to come from the MBA side. And I did that on purpose because one of the things I guess I failed to share with you is that my dad, the reason he lost his business was because his CPA advised him to expand into a recession. Okay? Now, if you recall, I had you turn around 180 degrees. Okay? Why would you ask that person for advice about what was on your piece of paper when they're actually looking, they're not looking at your piece of paper, they don't understand. A lot of people think because they know their lawyers and their accountants work with a variety of businesses that they can give you advice. I don't think so. And that's why I went a different direction. We're further on. So Logan's company, primarily, he has a lot of bank accounts, I talk about. But he's banking at Chase for the line of credit. What I advise is that he doesn't need more line of credit right now. I said, perfect. Go meet with your banker. Go sit down and, hopefully he'll invite you to lunch. Try and finagle that and get a nice lunch out of the thing, somewhere you like to go. But tell him, paint the picture, make it beautiful, all the things you're doing with the business and why, and then be upfront with him. At some point, I anticipate within the next 6 to 12 months or whatever, is realistic based on the financial projections we would make, we anticipate needing more line of credit. And put it back on your, first of all, that's how he makes money. So don't be afraid to ask him for more. He already knows you, and as he's getting to know more of your business, he's going to want to lend you more and say, hey, what is it? Ask him directly, what will you need from me so that I can get more?
Out of curiosity, these days with large banks versus our old, local bank branches and all, how much of that decision-making power is in that local loan officer versus underwriting in some back office out of state? Like, how much does this conversation matter?
That is a great question, because the real answer is that depending on the type of business you have, banks specialize in different kinds of customers, okay? And there are certain banks that specialize in business customers. So Bridge Bank, Heritage Bank, There's a variety, you know, Silicon Valley Bank. These are the banks that we tend to choose when we're VC-backed because they understand that business model and they understand how things work. Chase, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, those banks are more consumer banks. And they're more into auto lending or, home equity line, other kinds of things. They do business, but that's not their specialty. But at this level of business, you really both are open, but it depends how fast you want to grow. So to me, depending, you know, as a CFO coming in, if you really want to grow fast and you're going to need a banker who understands that, then I would start preparing a bank that understands business. And I would make sure, it's a great point, because I would make sure with your banker at Chase that he's really going to be able to grow with you. Those are some questions you should ask and let him know. Look, I expect to get to X million dollars. Are you able to handle that? And how are decisions made? Does it have to go to committee? You know, where is the decision made in the branch or not? How far do you have to go? How much can you lend out of this branch? So are you able to work with me? And you know what? Put him on his heels a little bit, because he has to prove to you that he can be the bank. Now, and I'm not saying you should move, because once you've developed a relationship, that's 80% of what you need, right? But you need to see also over the horizon, is he going to be able to grow with Lost Empire Herbs? One of the things I noticed in his financials is that his credit card merchant fees seem high to me. And the first thing, and when I said that to him, he said, yeah. He said, they penalize my business because they think we're high risk. I said, well, I'll bet, because you have very loyal customers, you're not getting that much in chargebacks, right? And he says, yeah, I'm not. I said, well, then you should be fighting for this. I mean, all these things here are not necessarily number one priority, but these are things that I was able to see by looking. He's paying something like $55,000 last year, I think, for merchant fees. And, but you don't have to just bend over and take it. You need to push back and you need to go for competition. And you have the ability to prove, based on your financials and your experience, people don't charge back. So why do I have to pay this? And
have you asked your existing processor?
No.
That's the easiest one, because they already have the relationship. Mm-hmm. It's not third-party data. They can usually just drop it for you.
And there's lots of competition.
Yeah.
So it's not that hard. But, I mean, again, I do agree that creating a don't spoil a relationship and give them the opportunity. But there's probably thousands of dollars in that line that you could be saving. The PEO, so he volunteered to me. I don't know how many of you know Professional Employer Organization. Do you know what a PEO is? Okay, so you know that companies have to do HR and payroll and benefits, right? But there's also workers' comp, and there's a whole issue in California. There's all kinds. It's tough to be an employer in California, there's no question. The legislature is lined up against you, and they pass rules in favor of the employees instead. So what has come about, and it's national, is these professional employer organizations. It was euphemistically known as employee leasing, but basically you enter into a relationship with this organization that specializes in doing all the things I just mentioned, the HR, the payroll, the benefit, and they're able to bring groups of people together. So now you're able to get what large companies can get in terms of benefits, and they can also save you a tremendous amount on your workers' comp. Mm-hmm. So the minute I said that to Logan, he said, yeah, they're cutting it in half. I said, great. I said, you're probably getting the PEO for free, right? So what he used to pay in workers' comp without a PEO, he's getting all these other benefits and that he can do.
Like TriNet and stuff?
TriNet, exactly. TriNet. They're one of the oldest. I'm in a group here with somebody called BBSI. They specialize in really getting to know the company and making it a personal appeal. And one of the things I mentioned to Logan is, great, first decision PEO, I totally support. Number two, it's hard to get a divorce. Once you get married to a PEO, the ideal time to divorce is December 31st. Because they have to collect a certain amount of Social Security and a certain amount if you divorce, then that has to start over with somebody else and people have to apply for that money back. So, and you end up changing all the benefits for your people and all the different kinds of things. So there's the big changeover is January 1st, and if for some reason you didn't make that date, it causes a lot of pain. They all have their own set of strengths and weaknesses, and so what I advise Logan is you really want to interview them, get the references, find out what, you know, is this a real good match for my company, because you really are getting married to something that you can't easily separate. But it's something that can, if you get the right match, can save you a tremendous amount of time and offer your employees a smorgasbord of benefits that you wouldn't be able to do without them. We're okay?
We got to wrap up within 10-ish minutes, so
yeah,
we're
going to do that.
Q&A,
yeah, okay, great. I think we're close to the end. One of the things that Logan's business does is they started a year-end sale process a number of years ago because they wanted to get rid of inventory before year-end for tax reasons. Well, he's now they've sort of trained their whole customer base that they have a year-end sale, and so he's created this situation, from my mind, that he could actually end up with increased inventory. The whole purpose originally was to reduce inventory, but he's...
You
have to get all the inventory for the end of year sale. So one of the things I advise is explore bringing the sale back into November and maybe part of December, or do it in other parts of the year. And then I started throwing out to him, what if we did 3 or 4 sales a year? Would that make sense? And or does that cannibalize, you know, the retail sales? And we need to, you know, decide how does this work. And then, so there were a variety of things that we talked about from that standpoint. He has many bank accounts, and so I advise simplification. And you know what? One thing I didn't tell you, but there's possibility for graft, for fraud. So the more accounts you have, the more things you have to watch.
For example, I mean, What would happen as a result of more employee fraud or just other people taking money out of your account?
Yeah, there's one of the things that I train my teams to do is that anytime there's a void in check, it has to be kept. It's marked void, and anytime we actually do a check run, I need to see that the numbers match where I was before. These are all things for Big Four audits. You have to do, the more accounts you create, the more kinds of things you have to do for, you know, like that to make sure. When I worked in a venture-backed company, I told my people, go lock up the checks somewhere where I don't even know where they are. And then when the accounts come in, I'm able to tell them that because my signature can go on those checks, I don't even want the responsibility of knowing where the checks are. There's a lot of things that the accountants look for to make sure that, you know, there's no fraud. I try to do things that way. The more accounts you have, it's just the more possibility that people can play games and do different things. And that's what you tend to see when somebody says, yeah, my bookkeeper was stealing from me, and they didn't see it. And it was something like that. They didn't have enough control in there for those reasons. You're watching all these things, so but at some point you'll grow to a point where you need the simplification. And I'm not sure if this is last, but he's got a great customer base. They're loyal, and he's already cross-promoting. But one of the things I felt for him is that you really want to find out how can you increase the customer base, because that's where his next benefit comes, is to get the revenue up. So that, I hope, gave you a summary of what a CFO is all about, what accounting is all about, what they're doing in the Congress, and all that, and what you could be doing for your company. And thank you for being the example. So, and that was just in a short review, and he felt that those were valuable things. If I were to be working with his company, we would do some more modeling on, you know, what are the product lines that are working, what's not working, let's get into 80-20, where do you want to expand, what kinds of things. And I would also do a lot more based on what he wrote down earlier, what's the vision of the company. You know, what I think he wants to build it and possibly sell it. He wants
to go back and build on this.
Yeah. And so we would talk about, you know, what to put in place and those kinds of things.
So out of curiosity, we've been using Logan as an example here, so let's just stick with that. Logan engages you longer term. For his business, these kinds of needs, is this a one-day-a-week kind of role, a one-day-a-month, an hour-a-day, once a quarter? Like, how do you determine?
So I think to really do this right, there's it's several days up front.
Okay.
To really get to know the business. And then we could create a plan moving forward. So we need to have those several days where partly I'm doing some of the research on my own, and I'm also coming back to him and asking him questions. And those several days probably aren't three consecutive days. They're probably over several weeks, depending on what both our time is like and what it takes to do the research. But then we need to create a plan. And depending on how fast he wants to grow and the kinds of things that we uncover and the things he wants to do, that's where we determine, okay, I would say to Logan, okay, based on all these things that we came up with, you could select just this to go after for now, and then you don't need much of, you know, you need me to check in periodically, and I need your bookkeeper to provide certain things so that I can be watching how you go after that. If your goal is to really zoom fast, like in most VC-backed companies, then you get up to where you need the guy. Gary Stroy was one of the smartest ones I ever saw. There were two things. His board asked him, why do you want to hire the CEO? I was number three in the company his first hire. So there was a founder, him, and then me. And he said, hey, we're going to grow like crazy. I need this guy. So then they were like, yeah, but we're a life science company. Why are you hiring somebody who came from semiconductor? He said, because everybody else around the table is going to be life science and knows how to do this med device. This guy was trained by the best. He said, anybody I've met in life science doesn't really know their numbers as well as the semiconductor guy. I want him here. The other thing that happened in that particular company was that it had started as an Israeli company. They bought this Skunk Works in Boulder, Colorado, and they brought the whole history of the company. It said they should have just bought the Skunk Works, okay? But it took us a year and a half to clean up all the stuff. There was a lot of bad stuff in Israel, and it was in Hebrew, and I had to find...
So was it right column, left column then?
Oh, yes, I had to do a... Yes, exactly. That's funny. I've never said that before, but that's good.
You can use that again.
I will. I'm going to steal that.
Please.
For the new Wayship?
I'm sorry?
New Wayship? Is that the latest company, the new Wayship, the one that he's working
on? No, the one he's doing now is, they actually have a small tester that'll do anywhere from 1 to 10 tests, and it's disposable. So instead of waiting for lab work, you'll know right at the doctor's office, and... There's an investor that's in the veterinary market, and so there's a bunch of ways for them to go. They may want to license some of the things, that, you know, and that's where they really need a CFO from that perspective. But they're working through something with the founders right now, so that may come about. Did I get to your question? I mean, it's variable,
right?
But we would come, you know, it would be also based on your budget, and it would be agreed to based on the plan that we came up with. In terms of how fast you want to go.
Well, you said that a good CFO should be a people person also. So how do you approach the people thing? How do you, what kind of model do you use? What kind of, you do it by intuition or do you use a model?
You mean me personally?
You come into a business and you evaluate it and you go, we've got to do a house cleaning here, you know, like kind of like what you were talking about with sales issue with Vern?
Yeah. I mean, well,
there's intangibles there.
There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of intangibles. So let me, so if I can go back to the company I worked with Gary's story about, we ended up closing that company in 2010 because there were a variety of reasons. The FDA became different, and our investors got a little bit of cold feet. We brought in the next round, and they said at the last minute, no, we're not going to do this. And it was right after the financial crisis. The biggest thing that happened was the people that we had in the company came to Gary and me and said, if you guys do something else, we want to be with you. Okay. So one of the things that has to start from the whole people thing is one of the things that I believe is that people are one of the most important pieces of the business. They can make or break you many times. And if they really feel invested in the company, you'll get so much more. So Gary and I, we couldn't share everything with everyone in the company, but we basically had monthly or quarterly meetings where we shared as much as we could, and people knew what that was like. And our doors were open. We were able to talk to them and explain what's going on. But sometimes you have non-performers. And the issue of that, it's a business. It's not a charity. So you need to give someone every opportunity to succeed, or every opportunity to make their own decision to walk, which we talked about earlier. And sometimes you have to give them a small push. You know, I think it's time for, there's someplace better for you. And you're doing someone a favor when you do these things, usually, because if they're not performing for you. But the things that I was talking with Jeremy about is that, look, you need, there's so many ways I could talk about this. We were talking about the analytical, the practical. Mm-hmm. The way my mind works, it's more than three-dimensional chess, you know? Mm-hmm. There's so many, I was so good at linear programming, if you're familiar with that. So it's multi-dimensional problem solving with a computer, right? And finding what the optimal solution is. You need someone who does that, but can also talk to people, to relate to people one-to-one. There's a lot of guys out there who just want to slash and burn, right? You'll get a variety of personalities in CFOs. You need one who's going to fit the person, your personality, going to work with you. Mm-hmm. Isn't necessary. I advise you not to get a yes name. Okay? You don't want that in the CFO. Right. But you want somebody who can point, you know, but maybe you're not somebody who wants it in your face all the time either. I mean, at Intel, that's what we did. Mm-hmm. But I found that it was more effective to really lay it out for people and to explain and to have them come to it as if it's their own decision. And so that's sort of how I talk to people, is, well, you told me this is the way you want to go, right? Mm-hmm. Here's how I sort of look at it. Here's a bunch of decisions. What do you tell me which way is going to be the best? Mm-hmm. I may already have my thought. And when you tell me that, I'll say, yep, that's the one I was thinking for you. And if not, I'll let you know.
Cool. Awesome. Great question to wrap up on. And additional questions, Hank's here today over lunch or just on breaks and all. Please continue to ask Hank questions. And that's one of the best parts about being here live is we get to have Jack ask questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
Really appreciate it.